everyone. Bienvenidos to InDocuTalks, the podcast created by immigrant youth for immigrant youth, looking at immigration through a lens of news, culture, and education.
Welcome, everybody, to our first segment of the show, the education segment, with your co-host, Rafael Martinez,
Frank Berlanga Medina,
and Nancy Canales.
For today's show, we are honored to bring you a special panel discussion titled Sanctuary and Sovereignty. This panel took place in Albuquerque, New Mexico at the Outpost Performance Space on March 9th of 2018. The panel was part of the 516 Arts exhibit titled The U.S.-Mexico Border, Place, Imagination, and Possibility. We would like to offer thanks to American Studies, UNM Art Ecology, and Chicana and Chicano Studies at the University of New Mexico, as well as Tom at the Outpost Space and Suzanne Sparge with 516 Arts for making this panel possible. Let's listen to the introduction of the show with Dr. Jennifer Denadale and Dr. Schreiber.
My name is Jennifer Denadale. I am Dene from the Great Navajo Nation, and I want to welcome you all this evening and also the panel on this very important topic. And my colleague here, Rebecca Schreiber, asked me to acknowledge that we are on indigenous lands and that we are on the lands of the Pueblo peoples of this area. That includes the Isleta, the Kiowa, the Santa Ana, the San Juan, the San Felipe, the Cochiti, 29 Pueblos, and also the Apache, and just acknowledge that we are on their lands. So thank you.
My name is Rebecca Schreiber. I'm a professor in American Studies at UNM. But again, welcome to our panel on sovereignty and sanctuary. So before we start, I just wanted to kind of clarify one aspect of the title of our panel, which is Sovereignty and Sanctuary. Basically, what we wanted to start off by just kind of highlighting is, you know, while there are different uses of the term sovereignty, we're focusing on the term as a way to underscore the self-determination of indigenous nations in the U.S. and U.S.-Mexico borderlands. So while the U.S. asserts its sovereignty over and against indigenous people, the statement, no ban on stolen lands, calls attention to the illegitimate occupation of the territory that is currently referred to as the United States.
Panelists included Professor Dr. Jennifer Denadale of the American Studies Department, Professor Dr. Irene Vasquez of the UNM Chicano Chicano Studies and American Studies Department, Nally Jo David of the Tohono O'odham Environmental Justice Activists, and member of the Torn Tohono O'odham Chumatkam Rights Network, Jennifer Marley, the Red Nation, Eduardo Esquivel, and Daniel Vega from the New Mexico Faith Coalition for Immigrant Justice. The panel was facilitated by Rafael A. Martinez of the American Studies and InDocuTalks podcast and Professor Rebecca Schreiber of the American Studies Department.
To begin the discussion around the ideas of sovereignty and sanctuary, the panelists were asked the following questions. How do you define sovereignty and sanctuary in your respective movements? And how do these two terms and ideas intersect? Let's listen to Nelly Jo David and Jennifer Marley's response that speaks to the possibilities of where indigenous perspectives might intersect with those of immigrants.
So the intersections for us being on the border, being intersected literally by the border, are huge. And in my lifetime, what it, the sanctuary thing for me, so before I existed, there weren't that many migrants coming through our corridor because it was a lot more open in terms of the whole border. But in the 80s, there was a push, and then there was another huge push in the 90s during the Bill Clinton era, where they closed up all the borders, and they had a prevention through deterrence strategy to filter them through our land. And so I grew up where this was just a common thing, where we would find migrants coming through all the time, just like, you know, you're just walking and you scare somebody because they're coming, there's just a big group coming through, and it's just common for us. And there would also be, it's common, it's a town where everybody knows everybody, so you have border Border Patrol kids, with Native kids, with kids of the ambulance. And so you hear from the kids of the ambulance, oh yeah, we came across some migrants in the desert. Unfortunately, there was a little girl and her mother and she didn't make it. And, or, you know, you'll hear another story where, you know, they got there just in time. There's just, there's a lifetime of these stories that I grew up with. Unfortunately, it was very normal to me in my existence. I didn't know anything else. And so it didn't really occur to me until after September 11th to get really involved in border work. Because after September 11th, that's when the checkpoints started showing up. And I had just, well, September 11th happened my first year of college. I was finally fleeing my hometown and getting like a taste of the big world. And everything, like the whole world changed that year. It was crazy. And it wasn't very long after September 11th where I go to visit my mom and dad and family in Ajo, and I had to go through a checkpoint. And so at that point, everything changed, everything, because we no longer were carefree or had the existence that we had before. From this point forward, we're interrogated every time we go across. And then knowing that we are supposedly a sovereign nation, and I did go to law school, and I'm like, wow, you know, look at all these other tribes that are asserting their sovereignty. We're kind of weak at that, and we've kind of the way. I don't want to take too much time on this question, but we haven't really asserted our rights when it comes to sovereignty on an international border. And so my goal going to law school, and I'm so glad that I went to MSU and I got to learn the Anishinaabe way just a little bit, you know, get familiar with some Anishinaabe folks, because they have some excellent legal minds that are doing... They're working, I mean, it's hard to work within colonialism. It's very difficult, especially with Indian law. We have the whole structure is colonial. We're still under their courts. And so it's difficult to work under, but they've done a very excellent job of having their lawyers work for their own people. And so my goal and my life goal is, if we are to live and exist under this colonial system, hopefully that's going to dismantle at some point, but if we are to live, I would like to assert what rights we have. And, you know, that's where the intersection between sovereignty and sanctuary comes for me.
So to the question, how do you define sovereignty and sanctuary in your respective movements? So I think the way the organizations that I've worked with and like predominant indigenous movements in the U.S. have interpreted the no ban on stolen land as one, specifically about the abolition of border imperialism, and two, as something that actually envisions sovereignty as something that will give way to sanctuary. So as Rebecca mentioned, the settler colonial context we live in is defined by competing sovereignties, where U.S. sovereignty asserts itself over all indigenous sovereignties here on Turtle Island. So I'm not just talking about us Native people in the global north, I'm talking like all throughout Turtle Island, all throughout Latin America, and the way the U.S. is constantly dismantling their governments there and infringing on their sovereignty. So in the assertion of true indigenous legal sovereignty within the United States, that sovereignty would negate U.S. notions of belonging, therefore making the U.S.'s notions of who belongs, who is a citizen, and who is not invalid.
Let's get into the latest from nation to nation. This is Sisters.
In this next section, Eduardo and Daniel talk about the real-life impacts of sanctuary and the immigrant perspective.
Being undocumented, you're sort of torn away from any sort of rightful home, or the idea that to belong to a place is to be officially recognized by its government, right? If you're where you were born, if you're fleeing because of violence, because of persecution, once you leave, you're no longer feel safe there. That's why you left. And so you come into another place where you also don't feel safe because you always have that fear, you know, as a child going to school, I'm gonna go to school, but how do I know my parents aren't gonna get picked up while I'm at school? Am I gonna have someone pick me up from school? Like that, these are things that are going on constantly in the mind of undocumented people. So what does that really mean to, you know, sanctuary? For me, it would be the ability to be out of the shadow. It's the idea of sanctuary really would be an ongoing project that I don't think there's any place right now in the United States that could truly say is a sanctuary, right? We're talking about some of the most high-profile municipalities like Oakland, where there have been increasing number of raids, workplace sweeps, and things like that. Even when we have, you know, arguably more militant mayors or representatives of the people that are standing up against collaboration between local law enforcement and ICE or other immigration agencies, there's massive pushback, and people are still being deported.
And my official title, I guess, is Sanctuary Coordinator here for the New Mexico Faith Coalition. We have two cases of sanctuary happening here in Albuquerque, where two individuals have taken shelter inside two separate congregations, for different reasons. So in the practical sense, sanctuary is a place of shelter. It is a place where someone at risk of deportation faces very great risk and danger if they were to be deported back to their country of origin. I think in its most symbolic definition, that definition can be given by the targeted detention of immigrant sanctuary leaders here in the United States just a few weeks ago across the country. And this was intentional and malicious. And now we're seeing ICE, a branch of the government that is very directly attacking sanctuary leaders here in the United States. And so right now I see really sanctuary at one of the many forefronts of social change. It is, I think it's powerful for people and communities across the country providing sanctuary. There's something deeply wrong about how this society is dehumanizing people based on the place where they were born, where they really had no say in the place where they were born, and how the U.S. turns a blind eye to its destructive foreign policy. Sanctuary is very, very related to that.
Professors Dr. Irene Vasquez and Dr. Jennifer Denatel talk about the academic and community impacts that intersecting and defining sanctuary and sovereignty may have.
I realize that sanctuary and sovereignty, that I don't think they're really acts, because I don't think they have a beginning or a finality to them. Sanctuary and sovereignty are really processes, or maybe they're passages, and maybe they're relations. They're things that have to be defined by the people.
I want to start by invoking the thought that is part of critical Indigenous studies, and that we recognize that the treatment of Indigenous people is at the foundation of how the U.S. transits and traverses as empire, and that its treatment of Indigenous people shapes and influences the way it also treats other people of color and women throughout the country, and that as long as the U.S. continues to refuse to acknowledge its inhumanity towards its Indigenous people, it will continue to be the empire, imperialist machine that it is, and treat all people and create these structures of heteropatriarchy, of violence and domination. No ban on stolen land. We are all marked differently for death. And we as Indigenous people also have much work to do, because my people, the Diné, don't think that immigration is an issue that is our issue. And yet we all meet police violence in very same ways. We need to recognize the commonality of the kinds of violence, settler violence that we meet, and that there were movements of people before international borders. There was race relationships, not of the making of settler laws and policies. We have come to believe in white supremacy, and we don't see white people from European countries as immigration. We've naturalized that as some kind of acceptable immigration.
Dr. Schreiber led the second round of questions for our panelists. Let's listen to what those questions were.
This may be a good time for us to ask you all to think about what impact you think linking these concepts, and again, you've spoken to that somewhat, the concepts of sanctuary and sovereignty, but what impact linking them might have for social movement organizing as well as academic research, which are kind of the two forms that we're focusing on tonight.
Nellie Jo David and Jennifer Marley answered the questions posed by Dr. Schreiber by highlighting or pointing to the limitations of tribal governments and that of Native sovereignty in relation to U.S. sovereignty.
To sanctuary, you know, a lot of people coming through are seeking just that sanctuary, and we don't have the sovereignty to give it to them. We can't even give them food and water without being criminalized by the Border Patrol and by, and oh, why are you giving them that? You know, and then people ask us for a ride where, you know, people are coming through constantly, and it sucks because, you know, you just want to help everybody, but you don't know anybody's situation. You don't know if, you know, they could be lived a squeaky clean life, never got into drug dealing, but they're at this life, you know, they're at this corridor or this place where it's life or death. And so there's a smuggler that offers them passageway. And so, you know, they could have drugs on them. It happens a lot. And then there's also, you know, the issue of poverty on our reservation. It's almost, it's actually very comparable to third worlds in some places. And we want to give, but we're being criminalized for giving. We get put on a list if we get caught giving anybody a ride. So it's like, oh man, like there's just so many ways where we need to explore this concept. And again, I thank you for discussing it here.
So when I think about how they intersect or how they should intersect sovereignty and sanctuary, I'm again compelled to be really critical of tribal governments and how they conceptualize those things and the like severe lack of education that happens. I think Native people, although occupied by the U.S. settler state and suffer and experience rampant violence within our communities because of this, need to understand how we need to be accountable for the way we benefit by living in the global north and living within the heart of empire, and thus how we benefit from the U.S.'s imperial endeavors all over the world, and how the U.S. Oppresses other nationalities that we need to be in solidarity with worldwide. So I think what would need to happen is tribal governments must change their relationships to concepts of immigration and borders. And hopefully from there, like a movement to create new political possibilities for tribal sovereignty instead of accepting our paradigm where we're constantly having to adhere to U.S. norms and like constantly having to live as these domestic dependent nations beholden to the U.S. And aspiring to incorporation into global capitalism. I hope that we can understand that we don't need to do that in order to assert our sovereignty, and that in doing so, we're actually positioning ourselves against people that we need to be in solidarity with, not only because that's what being a good relative is about, but because that's the only way any of us are getting free.
Daniel and Dr. Vasquez highlight the paramount consequences that the practice of sanctuary entails for immigrants in the U.S.
For anyone that's working in these cases of sanctuary, it's something very personal and visceral. It's how there's someone from the non-affected community coming into and volunteering for one of the sanctuaries. They talk to one of the two people that are in sanctuary, and when you find that piece that you can identify with that person, it's not like, oh, like NPR was right about that.
The intersections are enacted in our respective struggles is understanding sanctuary and sovereignty as our ability to maintain relationships that nurture life. I would say our ability to maintain bodily integrity and autonomy. I would also say it would be our ability to determine the conditions of a dignified life, free of oppression and repression, and most importantly, our right to defend ourselves as people.
For this next segment, we got to hear from the audience at the panel. Maria Lopez, a PhD candidate in the American Studies Department, facilitated the questions from the community that attended the panel. The following were the questions that Maria read to our panelists.
The first one is, what would happen if some of the indigenous peoples, nations, pueblos, asserted the right to shelter undocumented people using sovereignty to support sanctuary?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think it'd be wonderful if they were down.
I know a big chunk of us, Atam, are down, and I also have been thinking about that question a lot lately. You may have heard, it's been all over the news, it made international news, a man by the name of Scott Warren, a Mittagan professor that lives in my hometown of Ajo, was working with the Samaritans who are affiliated with No More Deaths, and they were doing just that. They were setting up like a sanctuary, and I haven't gotten full details, but I know that he is being prosecuted for felony charges for aiding undocumented peoples and having a safe house. It's so heavy. It's such a heavy thing because we're already, as Atam, we're already criminalized just for existing.
How do you understand the work of allies? What do you want allies to do?
I think being an ally and creating alliances and solidarities, it takes work, it takes commitment, it takes presence, it takes faith, it takes love. But I think also we have to recognize that solidarities and alliances are a threat, and that people will also work to end them. So we have to create those relationships away, I think, from authoritative systems and structures. And we have to stand up for each other, but really stand together against efforts that try to divide solidarity movements.
We just finished listening to the Sanctuary and Sovereignty panel that took place earlier this month in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where the goal of the panel was to intersect these two concepts and explore its academic and intermovement potentialities. Frank and Nancy, what are your key takeaways after listening to the panel discussion?
Yeah, Rafa, I want to highlight two important things that some of the panelists discuss. One, the historical processes that affect the effectiveness of indigenous and immigrant populations to employ sovereignty and sanctuary respectively are based on how violently the state chooses to police the parameters of those concepts that are rooted in the context of the U.S. nation state and imperialism and the allyship from those who are not affected by those given circumstances. Number two, the potentiality of the two movements to create new spaces for these two political maneuvers to effectively bulwark against state violence and policing forges a new pathway to coalition that is based on out-of-the-box thinking and critical engagement.
Here are the things I took away from the panelists' discussion. For one, the sovereignty in the United States is invalid. We do not have the sovereignty necessary to provide sanctuary for others. Questions turn into a mechanism of defense used to avoid helping others and providing a place of shelter. However, we can use sanctuary as a form of social change. Like many other things, there are solutions and resolutions that need to be made. But in order for that to happen, we need to have discussions, and of course, we need to be willing to listen.
That concludes our educational segment. We hope that you learned a lot from the panel discussion. Feel free to send us your thoughts on the potentiality of intersecting the concepts of sanctuary and sovereignty via Twitter and Facebook at UndocuTalks.
My name is Norma Ramirez, and you're listening to the self-care segment, where we will share four practical ways that can improve our emotional well-being.
What's that first section, Norma?
So the first section, we're going to talk about labeling our negative feelings.
Let's talk about our feelings.
Labeling our negative feelings can sound daunting and exhausting. As our different identities intersect with our immigration status, we may have learned to shove our emotions down deep into a hole where we hope that they can never be found. This logic makes sense when society tells us that having negative emotions is bad, and even more when having negative emotions makes us feel weak or unworthy. However, neuroscience tells us the opposite. In a study, it was found that people who try to suppress their negative emotions experience their negative emotions to the same degree or higher despite showing a calm outward experience. It was found that labeling the negative emotions actually decreased bodily arousal, where suppression had no change or increased arousal. So basically, saying, I feel sad or I feel angry will help your brain understand what it is experiencing and help it calm down.
So basically what you're saying is that it makes sense for us to be able to identify, label, and be able to write down exactly what we're feeling in that particular moment to be able to stimulate or bring about better results in that type of sequence.
Yeah. So we have two brains, right? Usually we think about the left and right hemisphere, but we also have the hind brain, which is considered more like a primitive brain, where most of our emotions are stored. And then we have the prefrontal brain. So when we are able to say, I feel sad or I feel angry, it helps our brain translate what we are feeling into our prefrontal cortex. And then we can start making meaning and understanding of our experience.
That makes a lot of sense, because many of the times I feel like we don't tell ourselves enough of like our own feelings. I feel like I talk a lot to myself, but maybe I don't talk enough to myself about my actual feelings, if that makes sense.
Yeah, we actually do more thinking. You know, we think that thinking is the better route, but if we can kind of go back and notice what our body is telling us, like, is our heart racing? Are we sweating? Are we feeling something? You know, what is our body telling us and being able to name the experience?
So what would be the second section that you have prepared for us?
So the second piece is that we can try asking ourselves, what am I grateful for? So it turns out that regardless of the emotions that we may be feeling, emotions activate our brain's reward center. So as we hear the news on recent immigration policy, we may start to worry, and sometimes people will tell us, don't worry. However, knowing that part of why we can't stop worrying is that it makes us feel good can be relieving. By worrying, we are at least doing something about our problem instead of doing nothing. However, in the long term, feelings like worry, shame, and guilt are not very useful. Meaning, in times when we are not feeling so well, it is important to remind ourselves to ask, what am I grateful for? This may sound like a difficult and even like a scary task. For one thing, we may not be used to asking this question, but on the other hand, what if we can't find something we are grateful for? We can't find something that we are grateful for, then we may believe that this will confirm our worst fears of ourselves and of our lives. But I'm here to tell you that neuroscience tells us differently. When we ask ourselves what we are grateful for, this activates different areas of our brain, causing a serotonin and dopamine increase that are associated with feelings of happiness. Furthermore, it seems that these effects take place regardless of whether we find something to be grateful about. It seems that the act of searching is what causes these changes. And eventually, we will have moments where we do find things that we are grateful for. Additionally, research has found that this can cause a direct impact on your relationships. When people feel grateful, they tend to do things for others that will make them feel grateful. And it can create an upward cycle of pro-social behavior and good feelings.
So that's kind of like the idea of, you know, we sometimes get stuck on the negative things that we hear. As you mentioned, with immigration, it's so easy to get caught up in the media, the news, the constant hyper alert that tells us there's always something going wrong. But what you're saying, if I listen correctly, is that we must step back and be able to focus on the things that we're grateful for. In other words, there's always these issues going on in our lives, but we also have to put it in perspective, being able to care about what we care about, right?
Right. And part of this is teaching our brains how to create new paths. So every time there's like a trigger, you know, like say, for example, you know, I smell my favorite food, right? Immediately, I may think, oh man, I'm hungry. And that's like, they're attached together, smell to hunger, right? But what if sometimes I want to go on a walk? And so I then have to be intentional about, like, even if I smell delicious food, you know, I still go on that walk. And that's creating a different kind of behavior that I can practice. Similarly, with our thoughts, it's easy to just kind of fall into this cycle of worrying or hopelessness. But we can also teach ourselves to make a different path that will help us not only feel better, but it will also activate the ability for us to do something. So even saying thank you to someone because, you know, they did something for me and I feel grateful, then that person is receiving something from me that will then make them feel also grateful. And it's going to create a cycle, hopefully, in our communities that we can all benefit from.
To ancestors whose hard work paved the way, and to everyone who's out there doing labor today, to my indigenous people and our creator too, we wouldn't be here if it wasn't for you. So thank you.
Thank you. On the third part, you were talking about decision making. Is that what it might be?
Yes, the idea of perceived choice is interesting. So sometimes when we feel like we have no choice, we may feel powerless. While having too many choices, we may feel overwhelmed because we don't want to make the wrong choice. In this situation, it is recommended that we narrow our choices down to three, and from there, we make a good enough decision. When we focus on making the perfect choice, we actually experience more anxiety and worry. So being gracious with ourselves and making the good enough decision will help us feel better by decreasing worry and anxiety, but also there's pleasure involved in making a decision.
So for the last and final fourth point, what do you have for us?
The fourth point, I have a little pun for it. It's to use touch to express and receive love and affection. And in our society, you know, with everything that's going on, it's a touchy subject, right? However, we're not saying that if you do not feel safe when someone touches you, that you subject yourself to that discomfort. What we are saying, though, is that we all have at least one person with whom receiving a hug from would be comforting. And research has found that when we feel rejected, we actually feel pain. And touching someone reduces that pain. This means that relationships where we feel accepted and loved are good for us. And a way to continue improving them is to increase touch, whether it's a handshake, a pat on the back, holding hands, or a hug. And in romantic relationships, you can increase cuddling or any kind of physical touch where you feel basically affection. That's going to help.
So in other words, it's basically always having a hugging buddy, so to speak, on hand or on call, if you will, to be able to help us through some of those hard moments.
Like I said, sometimes this is a subject that we don't like to talk about too much. Admitting that we need a hug is sometimes difficult, or just, you know, having someone, you know, like literally cry on someone's shoulder, like that's going to show just increased benefits. Like you will literally feel a reduction in pain, in physical pain. We can improve our overall well-being and that of our community by putting these into practice. So when you're not feeling well, how do you see yourself implementing the idea of labeling your negative feelings? As an example, what are you grateful for? Do you currently have a decision that is pending? Can you think of someone that you feel comfortable receiving a hug from? That is all for this month. Let us know what self-care rituals you are implementing in your life and when you have found to work or not. Share with us at OnDocuTalks on Twitter and Facebook.
Welcome to your Docu News segment with Alejandro Mendiaz and Cindy Nava.
So what's the chisme?
President Trump rescinded DACA in September, giving Congress a six-month window to replace the Obama-era program before recipients started losing their benefits. The deadline came and went on March 5th, but existing recipients are allowed to keep renewing their DACA thanks to a court injunction against Trump's order. Still, Congress failed to meet the deadline, with four bills falling flat in the Senate and only a conservative Republican bill that's expected to fail in the House pipeline.
That's right, Alejandro. And as we know, the top Hispanic House Democrat has challenged Speaker Ryan to sit down with her to find a bipartisan replacement for the Deferred Action Program. Representative Michelle Lujan Grisham, the chairwoman of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, walked uninvited to Ryan's Capitol Hill office to deliver her request, along with a handwritten note and a hula hoop. DACA recipients have shown that they're willing to jump through any hoop to stay in the only country they know. Let's show them how we're willing to do the same, read Lujan Grisham's note.
In the note, Lujan Grisham also asked Ryan to, quote, bring up the DREAM Act or USA Act without delay. The DREAM Act and the USA Act are both bipartisan bills that would provide permanent work permits and relief from deportation for a segment of our undocumented immigrant population. But Lujan Grisham said Ryan has jumped through hoops not to do it. No pun intended, right? She said, I want him to know that I want to spend some time with him to talk about these issues. She also said that she wants him to know that she wants to spend some time with him to talk about these issues and that they can start from a whole new baseline. But still, Lujan Grisham added that she will keep going to Ryan's office and ask for a meeting every day until they get something done.
Yes, Alejandro. And, you know, I think we've all been following this. Many of us have seen those efforts. And I want to know from your stance, how effective do you think that is? How well-intended do you think it is? What's your perspective and take on that?
I think that Congresswoman Michelle Lujan Grisham is definitely using her role as the chairwoman of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus to advocate for continuing to work on immigration issues. I think that this is a very positive affirmation that she wants to continue to work across the aisle, because other politicians might just try to come up with solutions in their own caucus or within their own party. But I think she realizes that being in the minority in both chambers and not having control of the White House means that there is need for collaboration. And the fact that she's willing to start over from scratch, or the fact that she's willing to compromise to come to a solution, means that she is willing to do something for our community. And she recognizes that they can't wait until Democrats are back in power or back in the majority, because our community has already been waiting and suffering for a long time. So I think this is an amazing gesture on her part.
Thanks for that, Alejandro. Meanwhile, the government showdown continues for the third time. Congress has to strike a deal on federal spending by midnight on March 23rd. Or else the government will run out of money and shut down again, Alejandro, for the third time this year. But with less than a week to pull together a massive spending bill, negotiations still have hangups, and lawmakers are taking the fight down to the wire. The government has already shut down twice this year. The first shutdown came in January and lasted for 3 days during a standoff over the future of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program.
Then in February, we had a small shutdown caused actually by a Republican senator, this time Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky, who shut down the government over small issues in the budget that he did not agree with. But the thing that was absent from this conversation was DACA and immigration issues. The shutdown did not happen over that. It happened over internal party dynamics about how much our government should be spending. And in fact, Republicans are now trying to slip in conservative priorities like hiking spending for the Department of Homeland Security, which of course damages our communities, to expand the number of immigrant detainee beds. What does that mean? They're trying to get more of us in detention centers. Mm-hmm. And Democrats are trying to push for a liberal spending agenda, prioritizing non-defense spending programs. While Democrats don't have control of either chamber, they can definitely block funding through a filibuster in the Senate. Republicans need at least 9 Senate Democrats to sign on to their spending agenda for it to pass.
Meanwhile, Alejandro, there's still a big question mark over what the White House will sign on to. As we all know, President Trump has called for some hardline spending priorities like defunding sanctuary cities and border wall funding that Democrats will almost certainly oppose. And ultimately, you know, the spending showdown will end in one of 3 ways. One, Congress can pass a long-term spending bill for once, or Congress could buy itself more time like they've been doing, or third, the government shuts down. What do you think it's going to be, Alejandro?
I think that Congress is going to continue to do what it's been doing for the past years, which is just continue to pass a continuing resolution and buy itself more time and not actually agree on a budget. It's very telling that the last shutdown happened because of a Republican senator. Their party is not cohesive. in terms of what they should be spending money on. The Democratic Party is not cohesive in terms of what they should be spending money on. And, you know, nobody seems to want to collaborate and nobody seems to want to give in to others' demands or to others' ideas.
I think everyone is getting these news from all media because they're out there, Alejandro. But I think what's really important here is for us to always look at these news that we're presented with through the lens of our lives, right? And of our experiences through that undocumented lens that I think not everyone is able to accurately see. And not just because we have this lens of being undocumented means that I have the same lens that you have, because I think we all have different stories. They should be respected. But I think even things like the government shutdown are hard things to explain to our communities. You know, if I go and explain that to my mom, I need to get specific about what this actually means and how it's going to affect their daily lives, how it's affecting my niece's daily lives. So what do you think, Alejandro, is a way that we can share this information with our communities, with our parents, with our tios, tias, so that they can feel like they're understanding and they're well-informed and aware of what's going on and what's happening that is actually impacting their lives day to day?
Well, Cindy, I think it's always important to explain to our community and to our gente how politics and policy impact our everyday life. And so, for example, when you have people advocating actively for a government shutdown, you know, what does that mean for our government workers? What does that mean for people who depend on those paychecks? When you have people campaigning and making promises to our communities that they're going to do something for immigration, you know, it's explaining to our families, how do we keep them accountable and how do we keep informed and how do we use reliable and factual news sources that are actually going to be telling us the truth of what we need to know instead of biased opinions.
Thank you, Alejandro. And I absolutely agree. And I think that's one of the main reasons that UndocuTalks has come together, Alejandro, because we know the need for information that can be transferable to our families and our communities, and that we're not just speaking academic rhetoric or political rhetoric, because it has to go much farther than that, to a place of understanding with respect and also uplifting, I believe, our communities, because our communities play important parts of everyday lives in this country, and they're valuable contributors. And I think for far too long, they have felt like they are not. And I think that is a loss for all of those people who have marginalized our communities into this one image of people, when we are extremely diverse, very powerful, completely committed. And I believe and I know that we are full of value and strengths. So UndocuTalks tries to be a reflection of that in a respectful way. And I think we are always open to collaborating with others.
This has been UndocuTalks. Thank you for tuning in with your hosts, Alejandro,
Nancy,
tu amiga Cindy,
Rafael Martinez,
y Frank Berlanga Medina.
Our next podcast.
It's the last Monday of every month.
Follow us at UndocuTalks on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram.